I don't know. I need that competition in my life still. And I just couldn't get it anywhere. So when I was freelancing, it was always competing with other freelancers. Who can get the biggest client, or who can be number one on the Dribbble page? So it was always like a competition to do that. But mainly a competition just with myself. You know, how far can I take this? I know I won't be able to do this stuff forever. While I still have the energy, while I'm still somewhat young, how can I just keep pushing myself physically and mentally and to see what I'm capable of? I definitely hit limits on a lot of things. I have anxiety. There's only so much I can handle, I can do. And all that pressure definitely did not help anxiety.
Welcome to the very first episode of The Creative Brief. Today, I sit down with legendary freelancer Dan Petty. We catch up on his career. We talk about a 30-day design challenge that he's issued to his community. And he makes some news by teasing a special event coming up this winter. You won't want to miss it. I'm Brian Athey, and this is The Creative Brief. Enjoy. All right, we're live. Dan Petty, what's up, man? Welcome to The Creative Brief podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited to be here. This is going to be fun.
This is the official first episode. I'm so excited to have you. When I sat down and made the list of white whale guests, never in a million years did I think I'd get you on board for the first episode. You were the guy. And you said yes. So I'm so grateful, man. Thank you for being here.
You bet. Yeah, I remember you came to my Epicurrence events, man. We gotta keep it going. So
I think I'm just waiting on you, man. I think that we're all waiting on you. I think that I will be first in line whenever you're ready to announce again.
Nice.
Dan, the goal of this podcast has been to talk to creators, entrepreneurs, folks that have had some success with personal brand. And I think you're the perfect guest because you check all of those boxes in a way that very few people do. Just to kind of run through a list, you are a storied freelancer and entrepreneur. You've worked with brands like Nixon, Adobe, Apple, Nike. You've been in Y Combinator. You worked with Ev Williams on the original Medium. You've been the documentarian behind Freelance TV. You've been the host of Epicurrence, like you just mentioned, which is maybe the most sought after, prized conference, non-conference in the design industry. You're a writer of the That Book series. You're the instructor behind Design Full Time. And, you know, Dan, you're always at the forefront, and you always have been ever since I started following you back in the Dribbble days. So I think just to level set, I wanted to see what you were up to. I mean, what is the latest with Dan Petty? What are you working on these days?
Nice. Yeah. Well, thanks for that intro. What am I working on? It seems like a lot that I'm working on right now, but it's actually a lot less than I have been doing over the past few years. But I'm working with a gaming company right now called Hytopia. And when I'm not doing that, I'm still making courses. I have a couple courses that are going to launch here again soon. Design process, portfolio course.
Nice.
And still planning events. So there's another design. I haven't fully announced this yet, but there's another event coming up this winter at some point.
This winter is in like the next couple of months.
As in, you know, I always launch the events like 2 months before it actually happens.
Right. Yeah.
I just don't like giving people time to plan. Like if you want to come or you don't, like there's no time to plan. I don't even have time to plan it. It's more fun that way. So yes, this winter in just a couple months,
it will
be like Epicurrence, but a little bit different.
Well, more fun, but also like, you know, I remember as you were putting Epicurrence together, I think the first time was just like, let's all go hang out. Right.
Yeah. 100%.
And then as they got bigger and bigger, you were like renting out these ski chalets and like personal chefs were showing up and like you were having these just amazing conversations. Like the thing that I don't know if people remember about Epicurrence is that the sort of design heroes, the folks that you see on all the, you know, at all the great companies and, you know, making the moves and, you know, kind of thought leadership on Twitter and all that stuff. Like they show up and they're just real people and they hang out like real people and you talk to them like real people and you sit up for late night chats and hang out around the fire and you really get to know folks in a way that you don't typically do at, you know, a conference where you wear a badge and sit in a conference room and listen to speakers all the time.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, you pay all this money, you go to these events and you just sit there usually by yourself, right? You might have a friend that's next to you or whatnot, but that's it. You don't ever get to talk to the speakers up there. You only get to hear what they have to say on stage, which is all scripted, right?
Right.
You might get lucky for an AMA at the end of their talk, but that's sure. it. There, to me, there was no inspiration behind that at all. And it just seemed like a waste of money for a lot of these people. And for the main reason, most people go to the events, not really to learn, to get inspired, yes, but really to network, you know, to get relationships, to have fun, to meet people. That's the number one reason to go. So yeah, with Evercurrents, we always made that majority of the time. So during the day, you'd go surfing, snowboarding, skiing, rock climbing, doing all the fun stuff. And then we'd come back for dinner and do talks and stuff.
And it's like, you know, Mark Hemian, like barefooted, sharing like, you know, deep cut stories from, you know, his time at YouTube or the Hood Sisters about like how they launched their business. You know, it's not that scripted talk. They are, you know, typically just like sitting in the middle of a living room and everybody's, you know, hanging out and they're kind of part of the conversation. So wild.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a really, really fun time doing all those events. And it's been a couple years, I guess, since we've done one.
When was the last one?
The last one was in Outer Banks, North Carolina. I think the year after the pandemic. Has it been 3 years now since COVID? I can't remember.
Ish.
This whole thing is a blur. But right. Obviously events had to stop, right? So that's the main reason the Epicurrent stopped. And then I tried to do one a year later and it was great. It was so much fun. We went surfing in Outer Banks. I think we had maybe 90 people. Such a good time. But took another break and then now I'm bringing it back this winter with a new name and a slightly new experience.
Okay. The first 5 minutes, man.
Yeah. 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 And I'll probably announce it here in probably a few more weeks. I don't know when this podcast comes out, but, yeah, it's going to be a good time. It's kind of an experiment too, in a way. Like with all these events, I try to see how far I can go. And to be honest, it started, yes, to go snowboarding with my friends because I was a full time freelancer. No one could go snowboarding during the week, and it drove me bonkers.
Right.
So I had to make an official event so people could come snowboard with me because I wouldn't go snowboarding on the weekends because I had, you know, kids and family and stuff. And it was always crowded on the weekends, you know?
That's right.
But I always went during the week, but no one else could go.
Bro.
So I had to do that. But also just to prove to myself that I could do something, you know? And a lot of people don't really know this, but I'm a very, very quiet, reserved person. And proving to myself that I could do something on my own and I didn't need help from other people, that was a big motivator to it as well. And that's why every event just got bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, I once rented out the entire Ritz-Carlton and Tahoe. Entire Ritz-Carlton. And I was like,
oh my God. Was that Montus?
Just a kid.
That was the Montus, yeah?
Yeah, the Montus. And it, oh man. You should have seen when I went into that to the Ritz to tell the people what I wanted to do. And they looked at me like I was, you know, crazy or something.
Who is this crazy guy with the beard?
Like they he thinks he's going to rent out the Ritz and he has, you know, $500,000 to do this. I was like, I'll get the money. Don't worry.
Bro, the pressure of that, I feel like that's like, it's one thing to be quiet, reserved, a bit introverted. It's another thing to like take on an event, but like the pressure of something at that scale, it usually takes teams of people
yeah.
to pull off events like that. And yeah. you were...
By all means, it wasn't perfect, you know, like there were things that could have been a lot better, But for me running it by myself, I thought it was fantastic. And it snowed the entire time.
Oh, wow.
You know, the event sold out. Every room was filled in the Ritz-Carlton. Everyone had an epic time. It was still definitely a highlight of my career, for sure, was pulling that off. And I mean, I didn't make any money on it, but I didn't lose money either.
Well, I guess that's what I was going to ask, is that you weren't just like putting an event on. I bet at that same time you were also like, you're very low key about the clients that you work with. Because like most folks that will land like a Google or a Nike or something like that, bro, that's all that you're going to hear from them all the time.
Nothing else from them but that. Yeah.
But you're like, you know, you probably working with Apple or something like that while you were throwing this event, while you had four kids at home, while like you were dealing with San Francisco and like the craziness that goes on there in terms of, you know, just affording the lifestyle. I mean, the tremendous amounts of pressure that you must have put on yourself.
Yeah. It wasn't easy, you know, but I've always been a competitive person, and I feel like it just, because I played sports all my life, always thought I was going to be a professional athlete.
Was that right?
And it what just kind of, how, baseball. I was a big baseball player. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I need that competition in my life still. And I just couldn't get it anywhere. So when I was freelancing, it was always competing with other freelancers. Who can get the biggest client, or who can be number one on the Dribbble page? So it was always like a competition to do that.
Right.
But mainly a competition just with myself. You know, how far can I take this? I know I won't be able to do this stuff forever. While I still have the energy, while I'm still somewhat young, how can I just keep pushing myself physically and mentally, and to see what I'm capable of? I definitely hit limits on a lot of things. I have anxiety. There's only so much I can handle. I can do, and all that pressure definitely did not help anxiety and stuff. But
I imagine, and then like, you know, I think you can't pull that off without, you know, kind of buy-in from folks that will show up and be a part of it. That will kind of go out on a limb and be a speaker or be a featured guest. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that's sort of like counter to that introvert line, is that from the very beginning, like you would do projects with somebody and, you know, you'd need a photo shoot done. And instead of, you know, just taking a camera out, you'd get like Dean Bradshaw, right? Or like, you know, yeah. you would collaborate and pull in folks that, you know, very well connected themselves. Like what were you doing in San Francisco to kind of navigate the dynamics of, you know, social scene and networking and all that stuff as a freelancer? Like, how are you finding your way into all these circles if you were, you know, sort of self-proclaimed so reserved?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, part of it goes to when I was in school, so I went to design school, and I always knew that the ultimate position, the ultimate goal in my career would have been to become a creative director. And at the time, that meant something, right? We're talking like 15 years ago, creative director was like the top at the design agency, you know. But the key to a creative director, which has... The term doesn't really mean much anymore. I mean, the startup world just totally ruined all titles. Creative director used to mean that you had a huge network of people. So you could come up with an idea on the spot,
right?
And you knew five people that could take care of it right away.
The best people.
And that was my dream position. That's what I wanted to do. So I made sure I spent my whole career, every chance I could get, making connections, meeting people, just reaching out to people, and not even that, to be honest, just like taking notes of who can do what, and they might even know I exist. Mm. But when the time comes and I reach out to them and there's a project, there's work, there's payment for them, of course they're going to respond.
Right.
And you know, becoming the go-to person that knows all these people was a huge skill that I really wanted to do. So most people just, yeah, they want to do design or product design. Yeah, I want to do that too. But also know a lot of people and make connections. Oh, you need an illustrator? Here's 20 of them. Which, yeah. Oh, we need this certain style? Yep, I know this person right off the bat. Like that was my goal as my strength in my career.
That's super interesting. Especially like, were you doing that through just like cold outreach? Were you going to happy hours? Like what was the mechanism?
No happy hours. No, I mean, I've only been to two events, I think. They just never interested me. Never interested me.
Right.
At conferences, besides my own. Sure. One was with...
which is why yours is probably so different. I mean, you designed it.
And the ones I went to were just like your typical event, hosted by great people, but just your typical event. It's not for me as an introverted person that I just can't just, and you know, I just can't sit there and focus listening to PowerPoint presentations or keynotes all day long. It doesn't make any sense at all. Like I can barely sit at my desk and design all day long. I need some movement. I need some action. And again, to that, I forget how we got here, but just one more point to that. Me being a more reserved, quiet person, if I'm out snowboarding and we're on the lift together, I'm going to be the loudest person out there. I'm going to have so many things to talk about, you know, and you won't be able to get me to be quiet. If we're surfing together, I'm going to be the one hooting and hollering and everything. And you're going to, you know, like, Dan, just be quiet. and I think other people are the same way. So I needed those actions, those moments to be able to, you know, speak up and just really be myself.
So much of like, you know, business relationships, networking events, things like that, you sort of wear your mask, you know, like they're a bit contrived and, you know, you're not supposed to pretend like you're there to, you know, get work or connect with somebody or offer work. You know, you're not supposed to be there for that. So you try and sort of manufacture these inauthentic ways to chat and connect. There's something about the type of camaraderie that doing something fun facilitates that's so much different than, you know, like you said, checking out a PowerPoint or trying to sit down for coffee and kind of manufacture small talk until you get to the point. You know, like it's a lot easier to come up with cool stuff to talk about when you are at the top of a blue or when you're paddling out, right?
Exactly. 100%. Yeah, absolutely.
I love that.
It's so hard to engage with someone when they're, imagine you meet someone and they're just talking about themselves the whole time. That's what a keynote presentation is. That's what all these conferences are. There's someone up there talking about themselves.
Right.
You would not want to sit there and talk one-on-one with somebody that's just talking about themselves all the time, unless you are actually interested and you brought up the questions. That's a whole nother story. No, you would rather someone ask you questions as well, right? And have a nice back and forth and just, that's just where connections happen.
Well, it's super
exciting. People want at these events.
Super exciting to hear that's one of the things kicking around in your head. But I also saw that you've just sort of made a challenge to your community on Twitter, X, Twitter. What do you call it?
I still call it Twitter.
It kind of
it's
going to
be a long
right?
time before I call it X.
Yeah, man. It's like muscle memory. Okay, so you sort of issue this challenge and you say, all right, we've got to show our work. This is your mantra. Show your work. Right? Like no matter what stage you're in, get your work out there, let that speak for itself. Mm-hmm. And you say like, all right, let's all take this next 30 days and let's update our portfolios and let's get something new out into the world. I think the question that I wanted to ask you though, is that like, okay, you've got this huge body of work. I know you've gone through iterations of portfolio. I remember in the early days, your portfolio was like a landing page with your social media stuff on it. You know, like
that's it.
You've got 30 days. How are you going to tackle this? What are you going to do?
See, that's the thing, man. Like, I don't put a lot of pressure on portfolios. It might seem that way because I do these reviews, but if you actually listen to the reviews, it's just the simplest design decisions. Put your work above the fold. Have a clean headline. That's all you need. a clear email. Like, somebody can whip that up in a day, you know, in a few hours.
Sure.
Everyone just overthinks their portfolios because they want their, because they're designing for other designers. This is the problem designers always have. They design for other designers, and it really slows you down. So, sure, sometimes a designer is hiring you, don't get me wrong, but you got to focus on the work. I've been designing for a very long time, and I'm pretty sure never is the right word, had a personal.com portfolio. Never needed it. Mm-hmm. We had Behance when I first got started.
Of course.
Why would I send people to a personal.com when everyone's on Behance?
Right.
Made no sense. And I'm getting featured on Behance every time I post a project. Why would I take them somewhere else? You know? Yeah. It didn't make any sense. Everything happened on Behance. And then Dribbble came along, and I'm like, okay, well, now great. I have two places, Behance and Dribbble. Dribbble was all the startup stuff. Behance was big clients, all the movie projects I got to do. A lot of people haven't seen a lot of the work I've done. And then, you know, just focus on that. Why do I want to send someone somewhere else? Why do I want to spend all this time trying to make a portfolio? So I just made a splash pages for myself, you know, in case someone does happen to come across danpay.com. It's a link to Behance. For a long time, it just relinked to Behance.
Right.
But then it like just has social icons on there, you know, a surf image so I can brand it a little bit. I didn't want to send anybody there ever. If I ever, remember when business cards were a thing, I'd give people a business card, it had Behance on it, behance.net/danpetty. Just go
How
there.
About that? Well, I think, you know, you mentioned something about designers designing for designers. From the beginning, this was like before personal brand was like something that everybody talked about. You were pro surfer web, right? I think you had a little foresight there in actually curating a story around who Dan Petty was. And if I remember right, like, you did that because you wanted to go after these outdoor brands and names like Nixon. I think I remember when you got that Nixon site, and that was one of your white whales. That was one of the things that you were always going after. But it's because you thought to position yourself for that company more than you thought to design for other designers, even in the day when there was a lot of competition to design for designers to show up on those front pages.
Yeah, exactly.
What was the thought process from coining that title? I think now you're the world's fastest web designer. Is that what's on your side?
Switching it up a little bit. So I stopped using Pro Surfer, and then parentheses was web, because other people started to steal my brand. Whether I owned it or not, who knows? I used it forever. And then other people started to use it. So I was like, kind of lost a little bit because other people started to use it. So I'll challenge myself again. I'm competitive. I'll come up with something else. Why did everyone hire me? Everyone hired me because I was fast. Mm-hmm. I don't over detail. I don't name all my layers. I don't do all this stuff. I don't waste all this time. I don't go hide for 3 weeks, then show the very first comp. I show the first comp the second I get it. Within hours or days, I'm just constantly sending the client stuff. So that's why they always say they love working with me, because I'm fast. Like, you are the fastest. They always say, you're the fastest person I ever worked with. How do you do this? It's so cool. So I just started, you know, picking up on that. I've always offered clients options. I mean, for years, even when I was pro surfer web, options. You have three options. I could do it for this price, or you want it really fast, I'll do it for this price. Yeah. And of course, they always wanted the really fast one, you know? Yeah. So I'm like, all right, hey, that's what people want. Now that I say this and that I see it more often, everyone's going to start saying that they're fast too, which is great. I hope they do. But they're not the fastest. I'm the fastest.
They're not the fastest.
Actually, I'm getting older now, so I'm probably slowing down a little bit.
Let's you think be real. So?
I'm 40 now.
I don't know, man. I feel like, you know, like I said, I don't see a ton of the stuff that you make, but then randomly, you know, you'll mention something about like, you know, one day I'm going to drop this Las Vegas Sphere project. Y'all don't even know. Like, there's all these little things that you're always kind of like crafting behind the scenes that, you know, the world needs to see, Dan. Where's it at?
Yeah. Yeah. I hope the Sphere website launches. It should have launched a long time ago. But we'll see. Fingers crossed it still happens. What they have right now is not what I did, but
I
think it's just a temporary page that's up now.
Well, with your as people sort of like, if they're, you know, if they're ripping off your branding or if they're trying to do the things that you do, that impersonation, I would imagine, comes from a place of wanting to get to where you are. You know, you just mentioned you're 40. You've been at this a while. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of stuff on the social networks and Twitter and especially TikTok and stuff like that, where people are like, they're really almost design influencers. They're doing their best to, impersonate the success that they want. Mm-hmm. But what was the pathway to get you in the door and NSF and getting connected? Like, did it just happen overnight?
That's a good question. First, I just want to say really quickly, if you want to impersonate's probably not the wrong word. If you want to like steal some of the things that I'm doing or copy or whatever, please do.
Trying to be friendly.
Please. Please do it. Like it works. It's effective. And I want everyone around me and everyone that's watching to be successful. So take whatever. I mean, don't use my image and my work, obviously.
Because look, people will do that.
Doing. people do it all the time. Trust me.
Don't dare
hundreds
them.
Of people blocked on Twitter because of them just constantly stealing my stuff. They'll steal my tweets. They'll steal my, just all kinds of stuff. It's so wild how people act out there.
Well, it's the fast track, anyways, right? Just do exactly what you do and they'll be as successful, right?
Yeah. So to hit on a couple points that we talked about a little bit earlier with portfolio, personal brand, and then what you just asked, when I first graduated school, I had a portfolio with just schoolwork and like work I just wanted to do for fun, really, right?
Yeah.
It was all outdoor related and surfing related, snowboarding related, skateboarding related. And I put this portfolio up because there was no Behance yet, there was no Dribble yet, there was no nothing. Twitter wasn't even a thing. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was just Facebook. Yeah. You weren't getting clients on Facebook at the time. Facebook was still closed. You still had to have a college email. Yeah. This is how long ago this was.
This is 2005, 2004, 2005. This was early days. Yeah.
Yeah. We were building Flash websites still.
Hell yeah.
So I had my Flash website up. And literally the week I put it up, somebody reached out, a client in San Francisco, and they gave me a call. First an email and said, can you chat? And I said, yeah, sure. I mean, I was hungry. I needed work. I just graduated. Right. Let's go. And they were like, hey, what do you think about the North Face? I was like, North Face? Dude, I'm wearing their jacket right now. Right. I love North Face.
Come on.
Yeah, of course. What do you think about San Francisco? Don't know where it is. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
California. I love California. Never been. Really didn't know anything of it other than surfing.
Were you in Tennessee at the time?
Okay. In Tennessee, in Nashville. Okay. And I'm from a small town in Tennessee outside of Nashville, but, a few days later I was on a flight to San Francisco. I was a little bummed to find out it was Northern California. It's cold there. It's cold. I thought I was going to be at the beach with palm trees and everything. It wasn't the case, but I'm closer. I'm still California. And come to find out, they needed me to help redesign the northface.com. I'm like, I just graduated school. But again, I'm very competitive. I knew I could pull it off. And this was just a luck thing. Mm-hmm. Just 100%. I don't know, right place at the right time. I don't know how they found me, but I don't know. It just happened. And I think my work was pretty good. I went out of my way to have really good work in school, and I always did more than the teacher would ask. Right. And I made my own stuff. Some students only do the student work.
Do the assignments.
I did the student work plus times five of the student work, then all my own fun projects on the side, you know, all the surf stuff and all this. Like I overdid it and worked full time at American Eagle. At Abercrombie for a little bit.
Shout out to all the ex Abercrombie employees.
Yeah,
I was one of them.
I was a janitor at the mall. I was doing all this. I mean, Anyways, I was constantly working. So my first job was helping redesign the NorthFace.com.
Through an agency or as a freelancer?
To an agency. Okay. The agency was called Fluid. I'm not 100% sure if they still exist. I think they do.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. They were an e-commerce agency. And I still to this day am obsessed with e-commerce websites. I mm-hmm. love them. Mm-hmm. If I could design anything, like seriously design something where I'm not rushed or whatever, e-commerce all day long.
Gotcha.
And so I got to design NorthFace.com. And I designed some other North Face projects while I was there. And I mean, literally, and I built the very first for this project, when the NorthFace.com relaunched, it's the first time I did a design in a long time. I built the whole homepage in Flash. It was all timeline Flash.
No way.
Made no sense. There's no reason I should have done that. I don't know why they let me do that, but it got cleaned up pretty quickly by somebody else. Okay. But it was the slowest website ever. Just an incredible experience. And I was there for, you know, here's the thing. I'm not proud about this stuff, but I am proud of it because I knew what I wanted. Mm-hmm. So that reason I'm proud of it. But I was only there for, I think, 6 to 8 months, not a year. And these people gave me this opportunity, you know, they gave me this job and right. I made friends there and like, it was such a cool thing, but I was a junior designer fresh out of school and I saw my limit at this agency pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. The work was, you know, months on a client, months on another client, months on another client. And I needed something faster. I needed more work. I was hungry, you know?
Gotcha. Okay.
I got to do the very first Reebok shoe customizer. I designed it there. Wow. That part was me. It was mm-hmm. so fun. But again, I needed to move quicker. I needed to do more. And so I left there to go work in an advertising agency called Butler Scheinstern Partners in Sausalito, California.
Okay.
And I got this job because my roommates in San Francisco was the interactive art director there. And he was just like this famous young person at the time. He ended up making millions and millions of dollars with all these products that he came out with. Before that, he was interactive art director, okay. Like this child prodigy type person. Anyways, he got me the job there because I wanted to work with him. Made more money. Now I'm no longer a junior designer. I'm only 8 months out of school, but lost the junior designer title, which was good for me. And I'm just designing so fast all day long on Mini Cooper, Priceline, Converse, EA Sports,
lots of exposure to all these dream brands. Yeah.
All day long, like so many things. And I had to do like banners, micro sites, and all this, $1 million website for Epson, the printers. You know, you got to do 20 banners for Mini Cooper in a day, and you got to be creative every time in this little box. How can you push it?
300 by 250. How can I do something cool in 300 by 250?
Oh, it was so fun, man. And I owe a lot of my career and skills to that job, particularly.
A lot of reps. Like you were just putting in reps every day. Yeah.
A lot of reps. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm already making moves, right? And I already have like 15 huge clients under my belt with agencies, of course, but I am literally the person designing these. Sometimes with teams, a lot of times I am the one. And a company caught wind of this in San Diego called Digitaria. And again, so I was at Butler Scheinstern Partners probably just 6 to 8 months again. Mm-hmm. Not a year. At this point, I've still never been anywhere a year. And they offered me a job to be the creative director. I'm like, hey, you know, I've only been out of school for like not even 2 years and I'm young and you already have a creative director here and he's a really famous designer.
Right.
I won't say his name, but he's a really famous designer. And how is that going to work? Because he's older. He was like how old I am now. Okay. But they tell me how much I was going to get paid, how much more I was going to get paid. And it was San Diego. I finally get to go to the palm trees.
Yeah, you get to go to Southern California.
Yeah, like, let's go. I'm in.
Let's go.
So I left there. and went to go at San Diego, and I was only there for 6 to 8 months.
So you were jumping around a lot early days.
Dude, yeah. I'm fast as I could go. But I hit it. I was a creative director. I hit it. You know?
So you're like less than 2 years out of school or 2 years out of school at this point.
And I'm there. And I'm making really good money, and I'm working my way up I'm doing NFL and out pitching the other creatives on the team, as this young person. I think just because I was just so hungry. I just wanted it so bad. They did too, don't get me wrong. But I just really, 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 really wanted it. So I was working extra. And I in school, I wouldn't do one comp and show it to NFL. I did a ton of them, and I'd already have it built. We still use a little bit of Flash, I think. Still build a little about in Flash,
So they could see that movement. Yeah.
Yeah. But then around this time, Behance was starting to become, pretty well known. And I had my work up there. And clients just started reaching out. Hey, Dan, do you do any freelance work? Google, Virgin America, National Geographic. And I'm like, yes, I do.
Something here.
I do freelance. Yes, of course. And I quickly just started to realize I could make way much, so much more money doing that. So I left there.
Providing that amount of value, working on that amount, you had the experience from all these clients. You fast-tracked it for sure. Mm-hmm. But... Mm-hmm. Like you said, you put in the reps, you put some time 100%. In and suddenly you had the confidence between the pitches and the deliveries and everything else that you had worked on. You had the confidence to say, all right, I'm ready to do this on my own.
Yeah. Confidence. Yeah. That was definitely confident. More just internal competition. How far can I push this? How far can I go before I have to dial back?
Yeah.
Earlier you asked how I got to know all these people was through that, I got to know all these clients. I got to know all these designers and creative directors and developers and agencies. That's how I first got to know Shane Mielke, the legendary web designer from Too Advanced. I don't think he fully knew who I was at the time. But we got to work on a Star Wars project together. And I got to see his Photoshop file for the first time. And that was the most inspiring moment probably of my whole career, was seeing Shane Mielke's design file of a Star Wars project.
How do you
seeing
mean?
How he made all this stuff. He just a button, one button had 100 layers in it of all this stuff to make it look so cool, So textured and metal and... That's back when we designed some really, 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 really cool stuff.
That's right. Throw a little noise on it. Throw a little noise on it.
You draw some shapes and a shadow and you're good to go. No. You couldn't do that back in the day.
Yeah.
That's how I was able to get a lot of those connections was through that. And just constantly trying to, prove myself.
Do you ever hit a wall? Did you ever find where that limit was?
I've hit so many limits. Before I tell you the first limit I hit, I do want to also say I was working every night, every weekend. When I say I was working harder than everyone else, I literally was, and intentionally.
Yeah.
Not trying to just be better than them, but just because to push myself, practice. If you want to be a good basketball player, you're going to go practice, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're just going to not be good, probably. Sure. Unless you're Steph Curry, you're probably good forever. But I was constantly practicing, constantly designing. And I'd every weekend at Butler Shine Star Partners, I was designing for their clients.
You were there?
I was there at night. First one there in the mornings. I wanted it bad. To get back to your recent question, what was the question?
I was just saying, you were constantly looking for that limit, and I was wondering if you ever hit one.
Yeah. So I've hit a lot of limits, but the first limit I hit was a really big learning lesson. So when you freelance, there's, especially in America, there's this thing that people don't fully appreciate, but it's called taxes. And they will come to bite you really quickly. So, yeah, that was my limit to where I was like, I need help, like financially and managing mm-hmm. the finances and stuff. Right.
Gotcha.
Because I, you know, that first year freelancing, I worked with Google, Virgin America, National Geographic. The National Geographic project alone paid for my whole year. I made more than I needed a typical salary. Wow. But I didn't save any for taxes.
You weren't taking out the quarter to a third. You weren't saving it anywhere.
I was young. No, I was more work's gonna come. Like, well, mainly because I thought I'd just keep working. Yeah, right?
Sure.
But like, I just surfed the whole time. I didn't work hardly at all for a little bit. Like I was so nonstop for 2 or 3 years. Once some of that money came out, I was like, all right. You know, I hit the creative director. I'm now freelance. I worked with every big client I possibly wanted to, except for Nixon at the time yet. Burton, I'm still upset with Burton for not letting me ever work with him. I haven't worked with Red Bull yet. I have worked with Red Bull, but at this time, not yet. But those are like my three big ones that I really wanted. Nike, Don, like all checklists. Mm-hmm. Next thing was like starting my own businesses. You know, freelancing is your own business, but like startups, a product. Startups were becoming a thing, you know? Right. My first big wall was like, there's only so much I can handle and managing financial stuff. Mm-hmm. So I had to do some big projects to make up for those taxes.
not just federal taxes, but when the state of California comes.
That was just such a shock.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, what? How much money do I have to pay? Are you kidding me?
Tennessee is one of those states like Texas that is there no income tax or no, what? There's something like that.
We don't have the, well, there's one of them we don't have. I forget which one. I still have someone else handling
it. I think it's state income. That's why you get somebody else to do it, right? Yeah.
Where you want to run a business here. Yeah. You don't want to run in California.
Right. I gotcha. That does it for part one of my interview with Dan Petty. But don't worry. New episodes drop every Monday, and you can catch part two then. In the meantime, well, we're a new podcast, and I'd love if you could do me a favor. Wherever you're watching or listening, I'd love it if you'd like, subscribe, comment, and by all means, share this with your friends. It'll help me produce more episodes and broaden the reach of this podcast. As always, thanks for joining. I'm Brian Athey. We'll see you next time.